From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Today I nominated a fine Floridian, Congressman Porter Goss, to head the Central Intelligence Agency.
President Bush nominates Congressmember Porter Goss to head Central Intelligence. We'll speak with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern and columnist Fred Kaplan.
Porter Goss knows a lot about intelligence, but he's too much of a shill for the Bush White House. He really cannot be trusted to produce dispassionate, apolitical intelligence analysis.
We continue our conversation with the parents of Jeffrey Lucy, a U.S. soldier who, after returning from Iraq, committed suicide.
He's a casualty of the war, and he'll never be known as that.
And the city once again rejects the call of United for Peace and Justice for a massive rally in Central Park.
I respectfully petition our mayor, who I believe is an honorable man, to be as welcoming, as forthright, as deliberate in his support of the Constitution and of our Bill of Rights as he is in welcoming the Republican Party to our city.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has nominated Republican Congressmember Porter Goss to head Central Intelligence. He's a former CIA officer. For the past 8 years, he's been the Republican chair of the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Goss's appointment has been criticized by many in Washington. The former director of Central Intelligence, Stansfield Turner, who served in the Carter administration, called the nomination, quote, the worst appointment that's ever been made. Senator John Rockefeller, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which will hold the hearings on the nomination, declared it was a mistake to select, quote, any politician from either party. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. In Iraq, at least 30 people have been killed, over 200 injured over the past 24 hours in intense fighting between U.S. forces and backers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The health ministry in Baghdad said most of the fatalities were civilians. In Najaf, the U.S. is continuing to bomb the holy city, including areas near the revered Imam Ali Shrine and the city's historic cemetery, where Shiite Muslims from around the world are buried. The U.S. is now saying that Marines have been given permission by the Najaf governor to enter the shrine to launch an attack. For the first time, U.S. forces are also calling on residents of the city to evacuate their homes in a sign that even heavier attacks may be planned. Meanwhile, Iraq's interim deputy prime minister called on the U.S. to pull out of Najaf completely. In Baghdad, members of Sadr's Mehdi army have taken over portions of the capital city and set up checkpoints. The New York Times reports practically all of Sadr City appears to be under the control of militiamen. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera is reporting that Basra's interim leaders are considering breaking away from the rest of Iraq and forming an independent southern Iraqi government to include the heavily Shiite areas of Basra, Misan, and Dekar. The head of the Misan Council said the move is in part due to the situation in Najaf. He said, quote, this reaction comes in response to the crimes committed against Iraqis by an illegal and unelected government and occupation forces who claim they came to liberate Iraq, but it turned out they've come to kill Iraqis, he said. In other Iraq news, the unelected Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has ordered Ahmed Chalabi's party to vacate its Baghdad headquarters within 24 hours. U.S. delivered the order yesterday to Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. On Sunday, an Iraqi judge ordered the arrests of Ahmed Chalabi and his son, Salem. The INC is the first political party to have its headquarters shut down by the new unelected Iraqi government. Again, the Iraqi judge ordering the arrest of Ahmed Chalabi and his nephew, Salem Chalabi. The Department of Homeland Security announced yesterday it plans to give Border Patrol agents the authority to deport undocumented immigrants without giving them a chance to go before an immigration judge. The new rules do not affect Mexicans or Canadians. The sweeping new power will take effect later this month. Backers of the policy say it is needed to deter undocumented workers and to net people trying to avoid tighter security measures at airports. Border Patrol agents are currently required to bring undocumented immigrants to detention centers in order to be processed through the courts. The new rule covers non-citizens caught within 100 miles of the Mexican and Canadian borders who have spent under 2 weeks in the country. During fiscal year 2003, about 43,000 immigrants were deported from airports and seaports without going before a judge. The new rule could double that figure. Another provision of the new rule will allow Mexicans to visit the U.S. for 30 days, increase from the current 3-day pass. Canadians are already allowed to visit the United States for 6 months. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has issued a new report criticizing Israel's decision to bar Palestinians from traveling on 41 roads in the West Bank. The report reads, quote, "By unlawfully discriminating against Palestinians based on their national origin, the Forbidden Roads regime is reminiscent of the apartheid system that existed in South Africa." Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning Israel repeatedly over violating Lebanese airspace over the past 36 hours. According to the UN envoy in the area, there's been at least 10 violations since yesterday. In Venezuela, the latest polls indicate President Hugo Chavez will likely survive the recall vote this Sunday. One recent poll found 45% of Venezuela was against recalling Chavez, 34% favored his recall, 19% remain undecided. Vermont has announced it will become the country's first state to sue the Food and Drug Administration for denying it permission to import prescription drugs from Canada. And this news on the upcoming Republican National Convention. Secretary of State Colin Powell has announced he will not be attending the convention later this month in New York. Powell told the Unity 2004 conference last week he's obliged as secretary not to take part in, quote, parochial debate. And New York City has once again rejected a request by United for Peace and Justice to hold a massive anti-war rally in Central Park before the opening of the Republican National Convention. The group submitted another permit request yesterday, but the city rejected it within hours. Now, protest organizer Leslie Kagan says the group may take their case to federal court. The group had agreed to hold its August 29th rally on the West Side Highway, but now the group says it is unsuitable. We have more on this story later in the program. All right. Yeah. Make the silent pieces sing now. Stop the war now. Everybody, don't put it off another day. Make your voices roar. Stop the war now. Just like thunder, y'all. Don't put it off another day. Sing a song. Stop the War, the late Edwin Starr. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 240 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and on both television satellite networks, on DirecTV, Channel 375, and on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has nominated Republican Congressmember Porter Goss of Florida to head Central Intelligence, replacing George Tenet, who resigned as director in July. Bush made the announcement Tuesday in the White House Rose Garden, and Goss is saying Goss is, quote, the right man to lead this important agency at this critical moment in our nation's history. Goss was himself a CIA spy for 9 years. He was stationed stationed in Miami during the Cuban Missile Crisis, then in Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Mexico, and Western Europe. For the past 8 years, he's been the Republican chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. The nomination, which is subject to confirmation by the Senate, comes amid calls for sweeping intelligence reforms proposed by the 9/11 Commission, including subordinating the head of the CIA and the chiefs of other such agencies under a single new intelligence director, as well as the recent report from the Senate Intelligence Committee on lapses regarding Iraq. Reactions to the nomination were mixed. Some government officials expressed support. Others came out in strong opposition, calling the choice a partisan political move. Goss criticized Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry recently for supposedly having voted for cuts in the Central Intelligence Agency's budget back in the 1990s. In the Valerie Plame case months earlier, Goss told the Florida Herald Tribune that the uproar over allegations that someone in the White House purposely outed a covert CIA operative appeared largely political and didn't yet merit an investigation by the House Select Committee on Intelligence. Goss said he would act if he did have evidence and said, quote, "Somebody sends me a blue dress and some DNA. I'll have an investigation," he said. Senator John Rockefeller, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which will be holding the hearings on Goss's nomination, declared it's a mistake to select, quote, any politician from either party. Former director of Central Intelligence Stansfield Turner, who served under President Carter, called the nomination, quote, the worst appointment that's ever been made. The timing of the nomination has also come under question because of the potential for opposition in Congress in the middle of a presidential campaign. A Republican political operative told the Washington Post that President Bush chose Goss because, quote, poll data showed Kerry had closed the gap with Bush on handling of terrorism. If confirmed, Porter Goss would be only the second Congress member to head Central Intelligence after George H.W. Bush. We turn now to two people for analysis. Ray McGovern is a longtime CIA analyst with the agency for more than a quarter of a century and one of the top daily briefers of Vice President George Bush. And we talk to Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for the online magazine Slate.com. He's author of The Wizards of Armageddon and a former staff reporter for the Boston Globe. Fred Kaplan, let's start with you. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of Porter Goss's relevant history here?
Well, his relevant history is that he is very much in favor of revitalizing the Directorate of Operations, the clandestine service of the CIA. And one part of the reports on 9/11 and the need for intelligence reform talks about the need to, you know, put more spies on the ground, to penetrate outfits like Al-Qaeda more rather than to rely on, say, Pakistani intelligence. But another part of these reports says that that intelligence analysis must be more independent, must not be so subject to political pressure. And that's where Porter Goss could run into deep trouble, because he has acted, especially in the last few months, as a shill for the Bush White House, denouncing John Kerry, denouncing Bill Clinton, staving off investigations. He tried to block the formation of the 9/11 Commission at the behest of the White House. And he's been doing this at a time when he's also clearly been running for this job. That doesn't bode well.
Can you talk about his history as a CIA operative?
Well, I wasn't really able to find out exactly what he did. I mean, these kinds of things are embroiled in great history. But a case officer in Central America during the 1960s, probably would have been involved in recruiting spies. He was in the Dominican Republic for a while. He might have had some involvement in support operations for Johnson's invasion of the Dominican Republic in the mid-60s. In Western Europe, at the height of the Cold War during the 60s, it could have been running agents in and out of Berlin. I'm really not sure. But, you know, there are two different kinds of clandestine operations. One, overthrowing governments, black bag operations, that sort of thing. The other is to assist collection of intelligence information, placing a radio, putting up a covert radioactivity meter near a suspected site in North Korea, putting a bug on a phone in Syria, infiltrating an agent in Al-Qaeda. And actually, I really don't know what kind of which type of covert operations Mr. Goss was involved in.
We're talking to Fred Kaplan, who has written about Porter Goss for Slate Online magazine. Porter Goss becoming a young CIA officer fresh out of Yale University. Ray McGovern, your immediate response to the nomination of Porter Goss to head Central Intelligence.
Well, Admiral Stansfield Turner, who was the last effective director of Central Intelligence, said it exactly right. This is the worst possible nomination one could imagine. I was doing a little research in my files, and yesterday out fell a Washington Post piece from the 19th of June, 1997. So we're talking 7 years ago. He talked about Porter Goss's committee. He had just assumed chairmanship of it, and this was the report. The CIA was criticized for, quote, limited analytical capabilities and, quote, uncertain commitment and capability to collect human intelligence. Went on to say that foreign language skills were sorely lacking. Okay, why do I mention that? That was 7 years ago. There is no more important, no more influential or powerful person than the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. He controls the purse strings, can do pretty much whatever he'd like in terms of monitoring things. Porter Goss has given a new meaning to the word oversight. It really became the House Intelligence Overlook Committee. And he bears as much responsibility for the fiascos of the last several years by the CIA and other parts of the intelligence community. He bears as much responsibility as George Tenet, and that's a lot of responsibility. So he's got a record, you know, and the record is not only of extreme partisanship, but extreme incompetence as well.
Fred Kaplan, can you talk about this comment and his position, because he has a significant position in Congress on intelligence?
Right. It is very interesting that until last June, Porter Goss had the reputation of being chumming up to the intelligence community, not really posing any difficult questions, challenges, oversight. Then in last June, he suddenly issues an authorization report for the FY05 intelligence bill, which accuses the CIA of having lost sight of its original mission, of being a dysfunctional organization. I mean, it was very strong language to the point where Tenet wrote a reply, a very angry reply, and disseminated the reply all over Washington. Well, in retrospect, this was right before Tenet quit or got fired or whatever happened. And I think it's not going too far to say that Goss was told that this job was going to be coming up, and he was being tapped as a possible successor, and all of a sudden he gets very critical of George Tenet. And it was also at this time that he was tapped on June the 1st to write the sort of official critique of John Kerry's major foreign policy address. And it appeared on the George Bush website. And basically, if you look at that, it doesn't say much of anything. It just says this speech, he calls it political me-tooism. He neglects the historic achievements made by this president and simply advocates things that our great president has already done. So this is a guy who did nothing for 7 years, and then when the job becomes open to him, all of a sudden starts criticizing the man who he would succeed.
Now let's talk for a minute about his attitude to the case of the blowing of the cover of the undercover operative Valerie Plame. First, Fred Kaplan, can you talk about his comment to the Florida paper? And then I want to get Ray McGovern's comment, who's worked in the agency
for a quarter century. He was asked about it. This was fairly early on. He said this is a wild and unsubstantiated allegation, obviously piled on by partisan politicians during an election year. There was no evidence of willful disclosure, so therefore no grounds for an investigation. The interesting thing about this, I mean, this was what appears to be the blowing of a covert, of an undercover agent for political reasons. This is the kind of thing that, any former spy or any prospective CIA director would be appalled by, would want to look into with the slightest hint of impropriety. And yet Porter Goss remained loyal to the Bush White House by just brushing the whole thing off.
And saying he would need a blue dress with DNA on it.
And then use the opportunity to bash the Democrats at the same time. I mean, it's kind of cheap shot that and against the just inimical to the inherent interests of anyone involved in intelligence. It's not the kind of remark you would expect coming from anybody who is about to head the nation's chief spy agency.
Ray McGovern, your response as a former CIA man yourself.
Well, there is an adjective to describe the reaction both of Porter Goss, Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and Pat Roberts, the Republican chair of the Senate Committee, and that is unconscionable. Here was a unconscionable act. Enough was known about which reporters called Joe Wilson himself to tell him about the approach from White House folks that blew the cover of his wife. Now, people need to remember that his wife wasn't the economic analyst on the banana crop in the Dominican Republic. Rather, she was running operations designed to stem the flow of illicit weapons of mass destruction to rogue regimes. She had her own network of spies, and all those people were placed in, we don't know what happened to them, at least I don't, in great jeopardy. So for Pat Roberts to reject Senator Jay Rockefeller's entreaty to please let's ask the FBI to investigate this on grounds that was, quote, inappropriate, end quote, and then for Porter Goss to make up stories about, you know, he'd need somebody to come to him and to tell him what happened when it was all over the press is disingenuous, at least. And Fred, I think you make a really good point when you talk about the abrupt change in tone on the part of Tenet last June, chumming up to everything and really defending the agency over many, many years, and then all of a sudden becoming its harshest critic. Well, I see the timing is incredibly important here. Around May and June, Karl Rove, as I reconstruct it, told the president that, look, you're vulnerable on two main issues, the fiasco in Iraq and the 9/11. So we have to find somebody to pin the blame on for these things. And as George Tenet, you know, he's willing to take the fall. Let's get rid of him. And then later we'll be able to say, well, yeah, it was bad. The CIA misled me, the president, talked about weapons of mass destruction and tricked me into starting this war. The CIA made me do it. And then with respect to 9/11, which they knew would be very much in the news, well, the CIA and the FBI all blew it instead of acknowledging the fact that there was plenty of evidence out there. It was the president's responsibility. So the name of the game here and the reason for the timing of this announcement is to deflect attention away from the president during these next crucial 82 days, have it all go to the CIA and its mistakes and so forth, focus on that. And what really, really amuses me is the Democrats don't get it. You know,
Fred, I want to just end with Fred Kaplan, sure. A comment that he's written in his piece. First, as the co-sponsor of the bill extending the Patriot Act II, Goss may be less keenly concerned about reconciling the expansion of covert ops with the preservation of civil liberties or about legal issues generally. In an interview with PBS's Frontline, Goss said he thought no laws would need revising to give a president the authority to order assassinations. Your final comment, Fred Kaplan.
Well, I think that's right. I think the curious thing about that is that here is someone who's the chairman of a House committee designed to oversee the CIA, and he's with legislation, with legal interpretation, and he's basically announcing that, no, it's sort of free for all. Do what you need to do.
Well, on that note, Fred Kaplan of Slate.com and Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for more than a quarter of a century, thank you for being with us. When
thank
we come
you.
Back, we'll be joined by the parents of a young man who committed suicide after returning from serving in Iraq. Stay with us.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way.
Buffy St. Marie, Universal Soldier, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. During the Democratic National Convention, we brought you a couple, the Lucys, who had just lost their son several weeks before. They spoke on Democracy Now! For the first time about Jeffrey Lucy, who committed suicide after returning from Iraq. Jeffrey had signed up for the Marine Reserve straight out of high school. In February 2003, 1 month before the invasion, he was shipped out to Iraq. He was deployed for 5 months, during which time he fought the Battle of Nasiriyah, returned to the U.S. Later that year, his parents, Kevin and Joyce, began noticing that their son was seeming to be suffering from something they've come to understand as post-traumatic stress syndrome. In late May 2004, they had Jeffrey involuntarily committed to a military veterans hospital after he ignored his parents and his sister Debbie's pleas to seek help. After a few days, the hospital discharged Jeffrey. 3 weeks later, on June 22nd, Jeffrey Lucy committed suicide. His father, Kevin, came home to find Jeffrey had hung himself with a hose in the cellar of their house. The dog tags of two Iraqi prisoners, he said that he was forced to shoot unarmed, lay on his bed. Jeffrey died at the age of 23. Shortly after his death is when we first talked to his parents. Today we bring you part two of that conversation. We began by talking about the two prisoners, as Jeffrey described them, that he said he had killed in Iraq.
My understanding was that there was a higher-ranking official who told Jeff, and this is the quote that is etched in my mind, "Pull the f***ing trigger, Lucy." And it was two unarmed Iraqis. He shot them from about 5 feet away, and he watched them die. It was the first time, that he shot anybody. He told me those deaths he knew he did. That's what he said.
And one of them, Debbie just told me on the phone that he said he was looking at this boy's eyes and the boy was shaking.
And he told me about all that haunted him was, it's somebody's son, it's somebody's brother, it's somebody's father. And Jeff, I think, was writing down when he came back, he didn't see dead soldiers, he saw dead people. And that was one of the things that I guess concerned somebody. And that's where, that was the beginning of the cancer of the post-traumatic stress.
He said he shot them where on their bodies?
Debbie said the one that was 5 feet, he shot him in the eye. And he just had the eye and the nose were gone.
And the second one, I believe, was in the chest. I thought it was in the throat.
I'm not sure of that one.
We aren't sure where he shot.
Jeffrey didn't talk to me, being a mom, and certain kind of, he would try to kind of cover up. He wouldn't say anything. Even in the letters he wrote me, he would never say anything. That would scare me.
When did he tell you, even the bits and pieces he told you about this? Was it a double shooting at the same time, the two of them together?
That was the impression he had given me. That was the impression he had given me. And that haunted him. I guess it was immediately after the shooting, he got their dog tags. And that's when he kept his dog tags with him. And
did you know he was wearing them?
I didn't know. God, he had been back. I found out in May. He had already been back home since last July. And I found out in May about the dog tags.
His girlfriend told his sister.
And that really concerned me. And I went and talked to Jeff and said, do you think you should? Because he said, you know, they're a constant reminder of something that was horrible. And he wanted to honor their memory. He didn't wear them as trophies. And he was very, in fact, his therapist, we were paying privately for a therapist to work with him, and his therapist also said that. Mark, he told me he never wore those as trophies. He wore them as a symbol of honor to those men. And
what did he actually tell you about the killing, and when did he tell you? Was it late at night?
Mm-hmm.
Where would you be sitting when he told you?
Well, when he was telling me about that, I was sitting at the computer. I was trying to do notes. And he would come in and out of the living room. And he was in his bedroom because he became more isolated and became more reclusive to his bedroom. And that night he came out. And he was drinking. He was trying to get me to drink with him. And then he started talking about, there was things that I could never understand. And that was his repeated phrase all the time. Dad, you just can't understand. You'll never be able to understand. I was very happy he connected with Mark Nickerson, his therapist, because I don't know if Mark was ever a veteran, but at least he would go over and see Mark. We would drive him over. We had to disable his car. It got to that point that we were really concerned. Mark, you know, made mention of that, and it was funny because he had made mention of that to me about the same time.
Made mention of what?
Of how people could never understand how how he murdered people, and he knew it was war. But then I remembered that night that he told me he would take his fist. And it was funny because they saw Jim Massey do this. He would take his fist, hit it real hard into his hand, and grind it. And he would look off in a daze, like, and he says, you will never understand. And then he proceeded to tell me about the shooting. And he said there were other things that he didn't want us to know about. He wrote to my brother, who was a Vietnam vet, and I need to sit down with my brother and see if he feels comfortable enough to see if he shared any more in the letters that he was sending back and forth to him.
Where does your brother live?
East Hampton, Massachusetts. So, but he's on vacation right now, so that's why we're having... But he may not be able to feel comfortable with it, because my brother, he was in Vietnam in war, and he was a LERP.
And he was what?
A LERP. I don't know what that is. But I guess it's like a recon or special operations in Vietnam. He got wounded.
Did a bunch of his fellow soldiers come out to the funeral?
Marines? Yes, they came out.
Tremendous number.
Yeah.
How many?
Very good. Well, he only had, I don't know how many he had in his unit, maybe, I don't know, maybe 30 of them came over.
30 or 40.
What was the unit?
Six Motor T.
Six Motor T Transport.
In New Haven, Connecticut. And the officer came up to me and said, each one of the men was a volunteer. So among the pallbearers, we had three volunteer to be pallbearers, as well as friends of Jeff and his life.
And these boys were very upset. They were crying.
Oh, they were sobbing.
It was just, I mean, you really see that, you know, they're all connected, you know, and they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that they didn't think Jeff would ever think of something like that. He just didn't give them any indication.
They didn't know he was suffering.
No.
But, you know, it was funny, and both of us said it to each other, as the Marines were coming through and they were sobbing, it dawned on me, they weren't Marines, they were just young boys. Gosh. Horrible way to realize it.
The dog tags.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how you found them.
On June 22nd, when I was going through the house looking for Jeff so we could connect, because we were supposed to go out to a steakhouse, if he could, I went to his bedroom and I saw the dog tags on top of his bed. And it didn't connect. I mean, we were tired. You know, we've been averaging a few hours of sleep a night because Jeff would get up at night and he'd be restless. But, and then I didn't see them afterwards, so I believe that state police in the investigation have them as evidence, as they have his suicide letters.
What did he say in his suicide letter?
It was hard for me to remember. I'm the only one that read them, and I was holding Jeff's body, and I was cradling him as I'm trying to read the letters. And he stated that he hoped that we would understand. He wanted to apologize for everything he did. He didn't want us to hurt.
He said he had a good childhood.
Yeah. He had a great childhood.
Yeah. We have part of one that was on a folder that apparently he must have been starting somewhere earlier. And I found it behind the TV in his room. And I said to him, I said, is this what he was writing? And he looked and he said, that's like the beginning of what's on the letter that he read downstairs. And that's what it says, Mom and Dad, you know, please forgive me. I'm begging your forgiveness. I think I already said I'm weak.
That damn weak.
I'm weak. I can't go on life like this.
The pain is too great.
The pain is too great. He told me once, he used to listen to this CD, Shinedown, I think it's called.
Shinedown.
And there's a song on it, Looking Down the Barrel of a 45. Well, he had me listen to that as we were walking down to a brook near our house. And I just listening to the words, and it's very, very scary. I looked at him because it just seems like he's thinking of suicide. Because it says, I'm looking down the barrel, and then it's saying something to the effect of, where is the young man, the he's falling to pieces, or I can't remember the words exactly, but when I'm listening to it, I said, this is like my son. I'm saying he's thinking this, that he doesn't know where that young man is anymore, and he's falling apart.
In about a week, Joyce reminded me about a week before, week and a half beforehand, here at about 11 o'clock at night, I have this 23-year-old Marine ask me if he could curl up in my lap like he used to when he was a little boy. Thank God I did. Thank God I did. You know.
His therapist said that he was regressing, looking for a safe place.
And we must have looked comical.
Yeah, my daughter was there. She told me that. She says, "Ma, you will not believe what Jeff did tonight." And I said, "What?"
But I say, "Thank God."
He wanted to sit on Dad's lap. She said, "I couldn't believe it, Ma."
And he curled up just like he used to curl up beforehand. And we were able to give comfort. But you know, one of the things I have to admit—I mean, people come up to Joyce and I say, "How we're so strong," and I say, "Bullshit," because you know, one of the things. How many families went through this with Desert Storm and all the other wars? And I read newspapers. I'm a news fanatic. And, you know, I never thought about the human cost. I never thought about... I would read statistics and I would say, "Oh, God, that's horrible." But that was it. And now it's thrown us into a huge, chaotic thing. And... I think I told Joyce and I want to be able to sit down with parents and tell them, if you suspect, don't rationalize it away like we did, saying he was just having a bad day.
Be aggressive.
And if anybody says that, well, this is what is, he'll be okay, bullshit. Don't believe it. You've got to go and
with your gut
them.
On this. Yeah.
Well, you did. You had him.
It wasn't good
didn't
enough.
Do enough.
It wasn't good enough.
Did they ever say to you the words post-traumatic stress disorder?
At the VA? When my husband called and spoke to the patient advocate, she said he had classic symptoms. When we spoke to the nurse on the floor who had been to Vietnam, yes, everything. But they did not...
No official
use it as a diagnosis because they said we cannot assess him for this until he gets dried out. And my thing is, after he was committed, he was dried out by Tuesday. Then they should have assessed him.
But how do you get dried out if you're suffering in this way?
And that was his
medication.
That's
why he needed it. Yeah.
The alcohol was his medication.
That's how he slept.
He passed out. He would drink until he passed out.
It used to scare me. It used to scare me because I'd say, "My God," I could tell he had been drinking a lot because of the way he was breathing. You know, and it.
And then, as we were telling Patricia, you know, when he was in there, I know that they had to do special observation. I know they have to restrict him because there's potential for suicide or to harm somebody. But the thing is. Jeff told us I was treated like a prisoner. Here I am, a veteran. They won't even let me have a cigarette. They wouldn't let him go to church. They wouldn't let him go to memorial services.
He had to stay alone with somebody on the unit while all the other vets went.
Kevin and Joyce Lucy will come back to their description of how they lost their son, Jeffrey. After we play you this song, 45, at the break, by Shinedown, the song Joyce described her son playing for her, that had lyrics, "In these times of doing what you're told, you keep these feelings, no one knows whatever happened to the young man's heart, swallowed by pain as he slowly fell apart, and I'm staring down the barrel of a 45 swimming through the ashes of another life." This is Shinedown's 45.
Oh,
45 by Shinedown here on Democracy Now! As we continue with the story of Jeffrey Lucy, who committed suicide after returning from Iraq, talking to his parents, Kevin and Joyce.
The weekend prior to the weekend before he died was a Friday night, and he climbed out his window without our knowledge. And apparently there were some neighbors down the street, some girls that were their car must have been right outside. He got in the car with them and asked them to drive him down to a store, which is close to our house.
He climbed out of the house. What was he wearing?
Out the window. When he came back, when they brought him back, and I saw him get out of the car, my heart fell. He was in his camis, his green camis, and he had his boots on. He had his hat. He had
two K bars,
and
those
he
are
had
knives.
Yes, and he had a pellet gun.
But that looked like a real gun.
It's been disabled. We bought it for Christmas for him. He had a pellet gun on him. So where his mind was, where he thought he was, I don't know.
We don't know whether he wanted to do a suicide by proxy where police...
I don't know.
You know, because of the police officer saw that gun.
It would have... Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so many things have gone through our mind. June 1st, he was discharged from the VA. June 3rd, he landed between two trees and totaled our car. Now, he believed that the VA told him to take 4 Klonopin twice a day. Well, Klonopin, I don't know anything about medications, but he was sober when he asked for the car. He left, but within an hour, he claims he doesn't remember. He landed between two trees. And we don't know, especially after hearing the other story this morning, whether it could have been a suicide attempt. Everything goes through your mind.
He was sliding so fast. It was one event after another. You didn't get a chance to catch your breath about what happened yesterday, and we were just in something else today.
And we were in total crisis. Even though that sounds foolish, it was like, what do I do? I would go to work, and I would tell my co-therapist, about two or three of them actually walked with me through all this.
You're a therapist?
Yeah. I work with sex offenders over in Connecticut. And that's another thing. I couldn't even save my own son.
Too close, and like you said, we didn't know what to do. We really didn't. And that's why, if other families are going to go through this, they need to know where to go, who can give them some help, and... It's going to be intensive. You can't just treat somebody like Jeff who was in crisis. You can't treat him on an outpatient basis.
The VA's got to develop a new system to respond to the veteran. I mean, the week before his death, he didn't drink. He stopped drinking. Monday night, he's sitting on the floor. He actually started crying and saying, I need help. I was sitting on the couch. Joyce was standing next. And then Joyce called the VA next day and said, can we get him to the program, a 3-week residential program up in Vermont? And they said, right now, he wants help. They didn't have a system to be able to respond to that.
They said no?
They didn't say no. She referred us to the vets in Springfield.
The vet
center in Springfield, and said that they were very good there and they could talk to him.
And we never knew the vet center existence until then, even though he had been discharged June 1st. And then
I spoke to David at the vet center, and I told him, I said, you know, Jeff is slowly dying here.
Quote, yeah,
and I told him, I said, my son is dying. And I said, we don't know what to do. And he said, he needs to go into a program, not to talk to people. He needs to be in, you know, where somebody can be with him.
And Jeff went through June 5th. Let's see, June 1st he was discharged, June 3rd the car accident, and then June 5th was, he was supposed to have graduated college with his sister, and regretfully all this exploded in mid-May, the week before his final exam, so he never went to take his final exams, and his therapist that we were paying for called up the teachers and told them, the teachers were great. They said, we'll give them until September. And then he woke up that morning. He was really good. And you know, as a parent, you want to reward all the... So he said, can we please drive... Can he please drive himself there? And I said, well, graduation's at 10. Liquor stores don't open up until 10. He was so impaired by the time he got to graduation. And this fire official from Holyoke, she was fantastic. She walked him in, found us. I walked him out and trying to... And the rage started coming again. But then he demanded, he said, look, I want to see my sister graduate. So he went up there. We have a picture of him. He broke into the crowd, hugged his sister, and then she went and got her diploma. We tried that day, that evening, to get him back into the VA. And I guess he wasn't bad enough.
Well, he was too intelligent. He knew that if he stepped in their doors, they'd have him. But if he talked to them on the outside,
that
he was okay.
Sense. Doesn't make sense.
And that's what they said. They said he was too intelligent.
He wouldn't walk into a building, but I don't see... I don't understand the federal government or what their policies are about.
You know, and thinking now, I said, my father went with him. My father should have went in the building.
Oh, they pleaded.
And pretend that
yeah.
he fell.
Yeah.
Jeffrey would have ran right in there.
Yeah.
And they would have had him in the building. That would have been there. So I told my daughters, I said, we have to be smarter than Jeff.
So the week before, he was involuntarily committed. Next week, and we brought him up there, we called. I told him what was going on. And then I called an emergency crisis center, civilian, for lack of a better word, and they said they couldn't help because he was under the influence of a substance.
Alcohol.
So
they couldn't help him.
Even the civil didn't respond to him. And he refused to have me go. He thought I had pull. That was part of the paranoia, but because I didn't really get him in the week beforehand, but because I was there and he was involuntarily committed, he didn't want me in the car. So his grandfather pled with him, his sisters pleaded with him, and somebody allegedly, according to Debbie, said, have you thrown your rope away, Jeff?
And Jeff just went like this.
Who said that?
One of the VA.
One of the staff
people.
At the VA yeah. that knew him from
the
previous weekend said to Jeff, did you throw your rope away? In front of whoever was interviewing, and Jeff
yeah.
just went like this, Debbie said. So it was almost like given an opening to, you know, that there is a... But it was never taken far enough. And like, legally, I'm sure they couldn't take him. That stuff, that's what needs to be changed. You know, he was on the grounds. He had family there. And that really, really know him. And my mother, she was at home. She was crying. Just seeing Jeff like that day, it was just, it was frightening.
And that was how many
that
days
was
before?
The weekend.
He was discharged June 1st. This was June 5th.
This is June 5th. He died on June 22nd.
Yeah. He died 18 days.
So like I said, it was getting progressively worse. We were spiraling down. It's just unbelievable how fast it went. Once it started, it just went.
He's a casualty of the war, and he'll never be yeah. known as that. And Joyce and I have said, there are so many, there's got to be thousands.
Jeff's out there, walking wounded that, you know. And maybe they don't say something this month, but maybe 3 months from now or a year from now, or... They'll exhibit it in other ways, maybe. I don't know.
Joyce and Kevin Lucy describing the last weeks of their son's life, Jeffrey Lucy, who served in Iraq, fought in the Battle of Nasiriya, came home, and on June 22nd took his own life. This is Democracy Now! As we end today's program with a controversy that's taking place in New York. And that is where the massive anti-war rally will be held during the Republican National Convention, or the day before it begins. Yesterday, United for Peace and Justice, the major anti-war group in New York, a press conference was held by a cross-section of peace and social justice groups, calling on the city to allow the rally to take place in Central Park. Leslie Kagan is with United for Peace and Justice. This is what she had to say.
This morning, we informed the New York City Police Department that we are not going to use the West Side Highway for the site for our rally on Sunday, August 29th, the day before the Republican convention begins. We also this morning submitted a new application to the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation seeking a permit for the use of the Great Lawn, the North Meadow, and the East Meadow for our rally on that day. We believe that exiling a rally to a remote stretch of Sunbaked Highway makes a mockery of the constitutionally protected right to freely assemble. We were forced to accept the West Side Highway site before major issues had been resolved with the city, and we have put every effort into making this site work. But it simply does not work. I also want to be very clear that we are still planning on assembling in the area agreed upon with the police department, and we are planning on marching past Madison Square Garden. I want to take a quick moment to explain why we made this decision. First, we always have had serious problems with the West Side Highway, and when we agreed to use it, we articulated a number of concerns and things that we needed from the city to make this a workable site. The city has not agreed to address any of our needs in a positive way. The major issues that have always been with us are, one, the city's planned use of metal barricades to pen people in. We have strongly objected to that, and we have not heard from the city that they will not use those barricades to create pens. The lack of water in that area, in an area that has virtually no shade and no facilities to access water. The need for free shuttle buses to transport people back from that area to subway stations. And, of course, the much higher cost for a sound system along the West Side Highway. We have asked for but received no commitments from the city to help with any of these or other important issues. In the last few weeks, we have also gathered other new information. Our medical people have advised us against taking people into this area. The costs for a sound system are even higher than we initially thought, making it virtually prohibitive to have a rally there. Press reports have indicated that the Great Lawn renovations were done, in fact, with the intention of making that space usable for large numbers. And a public opinion poll recently done indicated that 75% of New Yorkers believe that demonstrations should be allowed to take place in Central Park during the Republican convention. We also have heard from many of our constituent groups that they simply will not participate in a rally at such a terrible site. United for Peace and Justice believes Mayor Bloomberg, as he has done in the past, is trying to suppress and undermine freedom of speech and assembly in this city. We know that New Yorkers will not sit by quietly and let this happen. We are hopeful that the city will agree to issue the necessary permits to allow us to rally in Central Park on August 29th. But however the details play out, our voices will be heard. We will march against the Bush agenda, against their agenda of war, greed, hate, and lies.
Leslie Kagan of United for Peace and Justice. The city rejected the request for a permit to march in Central Park just hours after the request was put in. The group says they may now go to federal court. Our producers, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Mike Burke, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Neil Geiser, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.